Has the personnel board rendered a final decision?
Yes.
Was it adverse to Ms. Kirkmeyer?
It was adverse to Ms. Kirkmeyer.
Is it essentially just adopt the LJA's decision? Okay.
No additional findings or additional.
Does that mean an appeal is certain, is both certain and imminent?
Appeal is both certain.
Okay, is there anything that you wish to add to those statements? All right, on that basis, we are ready for argument. Now, these are experienced counsel. I assume you know all our procedures.
Members of the board, I'm Bill Finger. Good afternoon. I thank you for the opportunity to argue this sort of unique or novel type of employment case. I'm going to argue it in somewhat with a perspective that the personnel board matter will be appealed, which indicates Ms. Kirkmeyer would not have a position or will not have a position, but I'm not going to go into the record before the court at this time.
And our earlier order was not intended to preclude the possibility of oral argument in a second time either, so you really don't need to spend a lot of your time addressing the remand issue.
The real problem or the confusion in this case, or why it's appearing so often in front of the court, is the obvious conflict, inherent conflict, between the Constitution relating to the personnel system and the SES statute. They are just completely juxtaposed. And you could see that in the original order of the personnel board that came up in Kirkmeyer 1, that the SES system is a hybrid system. Well, it's more than a hybrid system. It's a system, basically, of at-will employment grafted on to a constitutional protection of continued employment. And that is the tension in the case. And ultimately, we think you're probably going to need to decide the constitutional issue and whether the statute is being applied in a constitutional fashion.
Mr. Finger, can I ask you, could you not, and I'll tell you, I find this case extremely difficult on many of the issues, so I'll confess that I could use help from both sides on this. Stepping back for a minute, the SES statute provides for annual contracts, and then obviously you can get to a place where they effectively become at will because your year is up and you could say gone. Would you address the possibility or the argument, potential argument, that when you sign up for the SES program, you waive your constitutional rights when you sign up for an annual contract to get the benefit of a 25% salary increase? That can be construed as a waiver, because someone certainly could waive their constitutional rights.
They could waive their constitutional rights, but in all the contracts Ms. Kirkmeyer signed up for, it indicates that the contract's void at the end of the year. There's express language in the 2004-2005 contract which says the contract's void as of June 30th of that year. Therefore, if the contract's void at that time, you're entering into a new contract each year where you have to affirmatively waive your rights in the contracting period. Does that answer your question?
So why does that necessarily invalidate the SES statute? Why can't you say, you don't have to get the benefit of this 25% salary increase, but if you want it, you've got to waive the rights you otherwise would have under the Constitution?
Well, the SES contract can be terminated before 1 year by the department, but clearly it's a one-year contract. And if you look at the total scheme of the Constitution, it's making a single type of personnel system that's a continuing right of employment, and specifically indicates you get certified after a year to position, and certification means you're continuing. It indicates that no temporary contract can be over 6 months, which these are, and they're clearly temporary contracts. And it just, what it has done is grafted a separate system which is subject to political considerations on a constitutional system that should be devoid of that. And it's just conceptually offensive from what the people enacted. And that's the problem. Underline. Further, we've argued that you can save it constitutionally, prevent it being applied, improperly applied. In the SES contract that Ms. Kirkmeyer executed, there is a provision in paragraph 4 which says if the executive director gives the employee written notice of non-renewal by May 1, the employee shall either be separated from state service upon expiration of the contract on June 30th or appointed to a vacant non-senior executive service position at either the contract salary or the statutory salary lid, whichever is lower. To save this system and not to get to the constitutional question, we think it is very easy to interpret the safe harbor language, which we've referred to, as waiving just the first term of paragraph 4. So if the executive director has an option of separating or appointing, and you read the guarantee to return, what has happened is the executive director has waived the first part of the option to separate. And that then becomes more or less consistent with the Kirkmeyer 1 decision that Ms. Kirkmeyer was eligible for an open vacant position because that's what paragraph 4 says, you get an open vacant position. So thus, to prove our case, which we think is more than demonstrated in the filing both at the district court and the personnel board, we've established faculty, there are multiple open positions that were existed. In fact, there was an open position that was announced 3 days before June 30th, 2007, which took most of Ms. Kirkmeyer's job responsibilities and put it into a new position, a general professional position that was not SES. And we therefore think that paragraph 4 can give you the mechanism, if you choose, to save reaching the constitutional question.
Does Kirkmeyer interpret the safe harbor clause as giving her a right to bump an incumbent that's in a position or only to be appointed as of right to a position already vacant and to which she'd been certified?
Our position will be that it's a right to a vacant position, to bump.
Thank you.
And therefore, we think that factually, if we prove, and that's what the affidavits and materials submitted in the district court were, that there was one or more vacant positions, that we have a right to be put in one of those positions.
And just so I'm clear, then it's your view that if we interpret it this way, both the safe harbor provision, I guess we interpret it that way, then that essentially obviates all of your constitutional challenges to the SES system.
Yeah, because we don't, if you interpret it that way and say she should have had a right to go back if we show a vacant position, which we did in the pleadings in the district court, and it's going to be shown also in the personnel board case, then she should have been appointed to that. She suffered some damages. It's just a question of getting an order to return her upon another open position being done and calculating damages.
How do you reconcile that with the last sentence of 104, paren 5, paren C, paren?
As to what?
Well, I mean, I think 104, I think the state would read the last sentence of 104, paren 5, paren C, as a statutory bar against any right to reemployment. So, sure. I mean, don't you see? I mean, I appreciate what you said about the contract interpretation.
Kirkmeyer 1 directly dealt with that. Kirkmeyer 1 directly dealt with it and said it is not that it is a preclusion into promising a specific position, but not to any open position or a general promise.
It isn't Kirkmeyer 1, I mean, they use the term reinstatement there. Isn't that a term of art under the state personnel rules that bestow discretion on the appointing authority rather than a right of the employee to a vacant position?
reinstatement is a term of art, but and it doesn't technically apply to this situation because it's where you're in bumping rights or another situation and is not as defined under the state personnel rules applicable to the SES situation.
Let me make sure I understand, Mr. Finger. I thought retention rights were bumping rights and reinstatement were kind of a discretionary reappointment. Maybe the definitions are difficult.
The reinstatement rights apply where someone has already left employment or where there is a retention issue. It does not apply to the SES conversion from the SES position to the traditional classified position. And in the original legislation that was enacted concerning SES, it was very clear, and that was the 1991 legislation, which is an attachment to defendants' pleadings in the district court, that it says you have a right to move back and forth within it to open positions. So it's very clearly contemplated in the original SES legislation that that would occur, and we think it's very clear that this contract gives my client rights, and she has not knowingly and intentionally waived those rights.
Mr. Finger,
the rest of it, go ahead.
No, I'll make it
4 minutes.
I'll make it short. Is there any question here that your client was a classified employee at all times?
No question.
Okay.
That's going to come to you in the state personnel board. She was a certified employee at the GP6, GP7, and management levels.
This may be an unfair question, so you can duck it if you need to. Do all classified employees have the same retention, reemployment, and reinstatement rights that you're suggesting Ms. Kirkmeyer should have here?
Do all of them
Someone not in the SES system. Do all classified employees have these retention and reinstatement rights? So you're basically saying she's always a classified employee, so to make this constitutional, she's got to have the same rights everybody else had, and that's what you're arguing for.
And that she didn't knowingly and intentionally waive those rights because of the language in this provision of this contract. And I'll reserve the rest because I'm sure you'll have quite more questions.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie Scovell. I'm with the Office of the Attorney General, and I'm representing the defendant, Appellees. I have handled the district court action. With me today is Mr. Vince Morcher. He's the first Assistant Attorney General in charge of the administrative matters. He has handled this case on the State Personnel Board side, so to the extent our discussion today delves very far into the State Personnel Board matters, I will reserve a few minutes of my time for him to answer those questions. There are two separate issues in this case. One is the validity of the Safe Harbor Contract Clause, and the other is the constitutionality of the state statute. As to the validity of the Contract Clause, the SES statute is plain. SES employees shall have no right to a position outside the SES. The Safe Harbor Clause was equally plain. It gave employees It provided that employees shall be returned to the classified service if they are not offered a new contract. Both use the word shall, indicating that compliance was mandatory, and they are in direct conflict. The statute bars an automatic right to return to the classified system, while the contract gave employees an automatic right to return to the classified system. And faced with this conflict, the trial court correctly concluded that the Safe Harbor Clause must yield to the SES statute and found that the clause was void.
Well, the very last sentence, you're relying on the last sentence of 104.5C.
Yes, I am.
It says, quote, any person in the senior executive service shall have no right to a position outside the senior executive service. given our mandate to interpret statutes to avoid constitutional problems, why couldn't we interpret that sentence by focusing on the word in to mean that the limitation only applies during the period of the one-year contract that's applicable? So the person, in other words, can't disregard their contract and try to seek a reinstatement right, but the sentence has no application once a contract expires and is not renewed.
It runs against the fundamental notion of consideration that underlines the SES system. The entire SES pay plan is founded on the idea of consideration that there is an annual contract, and it's 104 Section 5D that indicates that there is a negotiation of an annual contract and that the salary is keyed off this negotiation of the annual contract. If you permit employees to have the annual contract at the very high salary, much higher than any other state employee is entitled to, and give them a return to the classified system, they are having their cake and eating it too. And it really goes against the underlying concept of consideration on which the SES was founded.
So your position would be that by signing onto this program, you've effectively waived all of your constitutional rights?
Not all of your constitutional rights.
Well, relating to the civil service. You don't have a right to reinstatement at any point or to retention or anything else.
You waive some of your rights in the state personnel system, but you do not waive all of your rights. You would still have the right to all the leave provisions in the state personnel system, benefits. You would still have the same rights to appeal any disciplinary action or termination from your contract during the term.
Sure, but once the contract is over, you don't have a right to tenure anymore, which the civil service amendments otherwise would provide.
That is correct. And the SES statute is set up so that employees can make that choice. No one is forced into an SES position. As an employee, you can make the decision on the front end whether you're going to accept the high salary and take on an annual contract with fewer guarantees, or whether you want to remain in the classified system.
Well, here's a concern I have with that is where it takes us. Let's say we were to hypothetically say, okay, that program is, you're right, and you can have this SES program and you have to waive these various rights. What's to prevent the state from adopting 100 different statutes and creating 100 different categories where people waive different rights? Haven't you completely undermined the whole concept of the civil service amendments, which were to avoid precisely that problem?
In that hypothetical, I mean, it would take, I think, a great deal of amendments before you would get to the point at which the civil service system would be undermined. SES employees are not outside the state personnel system. SES positions are still subject to the requirement that they be filled by merit and fitness. They are still subject to the constitutional guarantee that you hold your position during efficient service, and that you can only be terminated during that period of efficient service for cause. It's just that in the case of an SES contract, the term of efficient service is set by statute at 1 year.
Well, and do you have any authority that would, if I'm understanding you, I always understood efficient service to mean basically you have to have cause to fire somebody. It's almost like for good behavior, a federal judge gets appointed. You're suggesting, I think, if I'm understanding you, that efficient service might mean somebody decided it's efficient to have one-year contracts. Am I understanding you?
Yes, you are.
Okay, and then is there any authority to support that? Or?
Article 12, Section 13, Subsection 8 provides that employees hold their positions during efficient service or until reaching retirement age as provided by law. In this case, as provided by law is the SES statute, which provides for the annual contracts.
But doesn't that get you back into Judge Gabriel's dilemma that if the phrase you just tossed out had the meaning you ascribe to it, then the state could completely overturn the tenure concept of the state personnel system by having, simply a number of pay classes, subject to various contracts, subject to various considerations such as you in suggested, at the end of which there are fewer and theoretically no tenured state employees left.
But we have to go back to the concept that SES employees do this voluntarily. They waive their constitutional rights in the SES system the same way that they could waive their right to a jury trial or any other constitutional right. There's no magic about the constitutional rights in the state civil service program. Those rights can be waived. SES employees do this voluntarily, and they do it for a reason. They do it for the advance in salary and, you know, for the advancement of their careers in a way that they would not necessarily have if they remained in the classified pay plans indefinitely.
So you don't see a constitutional problem no matter how many employees elected to go into SES-type programs and give up their constitutional rights as long as it was voluntary and they had the choice of remaining in a traditional classified position?
I can't say that in Judge Gabriel's hypothetical we could take this to such an extreme that we would never have any sort of ultimate constitutional problem, but that is not the question here before us. The question here before us today is much, much narrower, and it's simply whether the single SES pay plan is unconstitutional, and it is not.
You've addressed the issue of waiver, Ms. Colville. Can I ask you, let's say we get to that question, why don't we have a fact question on waiver here? I mean, at a minimum, we have a contract that Ms. Kirkmeyer signed that's, you know, says I waive certain rights except as follows, and then you got the safe harbor provision. I would presume she's going to argue, I certainly didn't intend to be waiving all my rights. I thought I had them. Why doesn't that at least get, because this, we're here on summary judgment, why doesn't that get us a fact question at least on that issue?
Well, although the trial court didn't phrase the order this way, the trial court did essentially find that there are no disputed issues of material fact on this point. Although the trial court sort of didn't label them specifically as findings of fact, the trial court's order on page 8 does say that plaintiff voluntarily entered into the SES system. She voluntarily entered into her various contracts, and there can be no doubt about her voluntariness as she drafted the final contract herself. And then it goes on to detail the ways in which the plaintiff was the appointing authority, so she was the person responsible for administering the state civil service rules.
Sure, but
be charged with knowing that.
But it's one thing to say she voluntarily, I don't think there's any doubt she voluntarily signed up for the program and signed the contract. The question that I'm raising is, did she voluntarily waive her right to get back into, you know, a classified position or be entitled to a vacant one? She signed a contract that she wrote, I suppose, or parts of it, that said, I get a position back. And I guess maybe the court just didn't address that question, and I'm not sure whether the parties addressed that question, but I have a real concern about that.
They did address that question, and if you look to defendant's motion for summary judgment, their response to plaintiff's motion, and our reply, you'll find the factual citations to Ms. Kirkmeyer's testimony indicating that she did understand that she did not have a guarantee in state employment going forward once she joined the SES program.
Isn't the last contract inconsistent on its face as between paragraph 4 and paragraph 7, which would seem to me alone creates a fact issue as to what she intended, whether she was the drafter or the signatory or both of that contract? I mean, why, for to defeat summary judgment, I'm not asking you to give up your case on the merits, why can't she simply say those paragraph 7 and paragraph 4 are flatly contradictory, therefore I'm entitled to a jury trial on the issue of waiver and intent?
Well, first of all, she did not make that argument. This is the first time that argument has been raised in any of the proceedings. And Ms. Kirkmeyer's testimony has been that she did understand what the safe harbor clause was supposed to do, and there is a contradiction on the face of the contract, but the later provision indicates that without regard to paragraph 4 above, the employee shall be returned to the classified service, indicating an intention not to abide by paragraph 4.
So why doesn't that create a factual dispute inappropriate for summary judgment? Not necessarily a loser for the state on the merits, as to waiver.
Well, looking at the record as a whole, the trial court did consider testimony that was presented on the issue of waiver and found that the preponderance of the evidence showed that there was not.
Excuse me, that's not a summary judgment standard. We review summary judgment de novo, and the trial court can't enter summary judgment by weighing the evidence. So why isn't the contract, the facial inconsistency within the contract alone a factual issue that needs to be resolved? Particularly if you essentially rest your argument on waiver.
Because the remainder of the evidence that was before the trial court relating to the issue of waiver indicated that Ms. Kirkmeyer, in fact, did voluntarily and knowingly waive her rights to continued employment in senior executive service, in the classified service program.
Let me return to a comment you made, and I want to be sure I understood it. I believe you said that during the term of these one-year contracts, the employee did have the 10-year protection of efficient service?
I'm sorry. What the employee has during that contract term is the full panoply of grievance and appeal rights.
Well, where do the statutes guarantee those rights, 104.5 C and D?
It does not stem from the statute. It comes from the state personnel board rules.
Okay. Is there a state person, and I'm sure you know these vastly better than me at least, is there a state personnel board rule that is specifically says during the term of these one-year contracts, the employee can be separated only for good cause?
What the state employment rules say are, it's rule 2-11 subparagraph A.
Got that in front
of me. I apologize, it's 2-2. The final sentence of that subsection says, all provisions of the rules apply to employees in the senior executive service unless specifically noted otherwise. And I believe it's in one other place.
Sorry, Ms. Goldberg, I didn't catch the first rule. I've got the rules here, too.
Sure. 2-12, the final sentence of that paragraph indicates that all other provisions of the rules apply to employees in the senior executive service unless specifically noted otherwise.
I see it. I apologize.
And then 2-11, subparagraph C, is really the operative paragraph, and this states that as part of the negotiation process, this is the second sentence, and in consideration for a salary that exceeds the maximum of the management class, an employee entering into an SES contract may be required to waive all appeal, disciplinary grievance, and other rights and privileges in the state personnel system with respect to the expiration of the non-renewed contract.
But your interpretation of 211C is that it waives only rights that ripen when the contract is non-renewed. It doesn't waive any rights during the term of the contract.
That's absolutely right.
Thank you.
I see that my time has just about expired. Does the court have any further questions for the state? Thank you.
Before I start off, I'm going to return a pen to opposing counsel.
I like to see that professionalism, counsel.
Okay, we try and be nice. There's a misconception that apparently is not really being flushed out, and that's that this safe harbor provision language was not mandatory. This was discretionary, department by department. It was something that it was an option that was created by Mr. Wells. Thus, the negotiation process in creating these contracts is one of whether that will be in or not. If the executive directors choose to not have them in and mandate the provision of paragraph 4, they can do that. But in this case, it didn't happen.
How does Ms. Kirkmeyer get any benefit from that argument, though, since she negotiated the contract with herself?
No, she didn't. The contract was signed by the governor's office.
Is there anything in the record indicating that that was a negotiation as opposed to her just walking it over to the governor's office and saying, I don't feel real good about signing both sides of this contract, somebody else better sign it?
Yeah, in the record, she was told to do that by Mr. Wells. That was the appropriate party to get the permission. And the way it came about is the language was previewed at the governor's staff meeting with the governor's attorney and the governor's chief of staff and the governors. And they allowed that language to occur and the executive directors to have it. We've provided in the district court the testimony of Mr. Wells concerning that process and the testimony of Ms. Kirkmeyer. And when Ms. Kirkmeyer entered into this contract, and there's testimony in the district court to this effect through her deposition, was because it was an election year, she would not have executed an SES contract but for the promise to return. So that answers the question about intentional waiver, I believe. This was not the only SES contract where it had this language. In the district court, we provided information the year before similar language was in a contract. We provided material that the Department of Personnel had this in their contract, Mr. Wells' own organization, and certain other departments. So it was a freely negotiated type of concept and proved by the individual who is the constitutional authority to oversee the SES system, Mr. Wells. It was he that came up with the language. It wasn't something Ms. Kirkmeyer did. It was he that approved the language pursuant to his ability to establish rules on pay plans, which is statutory. And it was a situation where clearly there was not an intelligent, knowing waiver as required by constitutional law or by state personnel rule.
Ask you a couple of more mechanical questions. Let's assume that we were to rule that the safe harbor clause was enforceable and to reverse and remand on that basis. Would there be anything left of your other claims like political discrimination, or is it at that point it's just a breach of contract case?
It may. The political affiliation issue would probably still be alive because the basis of all the court's ruling below at the district court was that the term was void.
Okay, let's assume we say that's wrong.
Then
the safe harbor clause is enforceable. Is there any other issue left to be decided on remand? Damages, of course.
Well, I think we're entitled to summary judgment at that point because of the position, and it's a damage trial.
Okay, related question. Let's assume we were to rule that the safe harbor clause is enforceable. Does that leave anything to be resolved by Mr. Gonzalez in terms of Ms. Kirkmeyer's appeal to him, perhaps under the doctrine of primary jurisdiction, or is it just a district court action? What's your position?
It goes back to the district court action with directions that they enter, directions to Mr. Gonzalez to reverse his decision.
Thank you. That is the only case we have on the calendar this afternoon. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. They've been very helpful. We are in recess. A written decision will be announced. Well, actually, a written decision will not be announced until either it can be consolidated with the promised appeal in the other case or the appeal in that case has run, the appeal deadline. In any event, at some point, there will be a written decision in this case. If either side requests oral argument in the second case, assuming an appeal has been filed, we will evaluate it separately. Bailiff may announce a recess.